Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Live today from the Green Space, WNYC's ground floor theater on Barrett Street in Lower Manhattan, it's The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. To our Green Space audience, thanks for coming out, everybody who came down here this morning on another mild February day. Give yourselves a round of applause. Such a beautiful day. This might be how global warming will get us. It lulls people in the northern hemisphere to go, hey, this really isn't so bad. And then half the southern hemisphere turns into desert, prompting water wars and millions of refugees who the northern hemisphere won't take because they're angry and they don't love America enough. And you can write your own alternative futures from there. On that cheery note, let's get started. In the Green Space today, we will have our own congressional town hall meeting with Brooklyn Congresswoman Yvette Clark. She will talk about being a House Democrat in the supercharged environment right now and what they can get done or what they can resist without controlling any branch of government. I'll also ask about protecting the large immigrant community in her district. Some of you may know that the Congresswoman's mother, Una Clark, was the first Caribbean-born woman ever elected to the New York City Council. Also, we're taking advantage of the fact that today is a school holiday. We'll have a panel of public school teachers from New York and New Jersey, from both district schools and charter schools, to anticipate education in our area in the Betsy DeVos era and talk about things beyond Betsy DeVos. That'll be later as well. But to begin, we have an all-star trio on the main news of the day on our main stage here in the Green Space. Okay, it's our only stage. Jameel Smith and Anna Marie Cox, the national political reporters for MTV News, good friends of the show, who are kind enough to come down and do this in person today. Anna Marie actually lives in Minnesota, so we're extra lucky that she's in New York today. And we have Slate's War Stories columnist, Fred Kaplan, whose work is very relevant to what's going on right now. His current book is Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. He's been a Moscow correspondent for the Boston Globe, and the new national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, figures prominently in Fred's previous book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. So hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Great to be here.
And one of your claims to fame is that you've actually interviewed General McMaster?
I'm far from the only one who's done that. He was pretty open to the press. But yeah, I've known him for quite some time.
And Anna Marie and Jameel, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Anna Marie, I see one of your claims to fame is that you actually interviewed Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yes. Milo, get your yayas out.
So our topics will run the gamut from the sublime to the grotesque on the Green Space today. How much of a hate monger does one have to be to get disinvited from the CPAC conference? The answer seems to be any kind of hate monger of disfavored group is okay as long as you don't condone pedophilia. The standards for Bill Maher are still being developed. We will get to that too. And listeners, we'll take some questions from our Green Space audience today, but our phones are also open as usual, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Fred, your article on Slate is titled, Trump Just Hired the Army's Smartest Officer. He is?
Well, I haven't done a comprehensive survey, but that's sort of his reputation, and I wouldn't doubt it. He's generally an intellectual. I mean, he reads history. He has a PhD in history. He thinks about ideas. Most of his last few commands in the Army have been dealing with strategy and doctrine and the future of the Army and the future of war. He doesn't look, I mean, you've seen the pictures of him in the newspaper. He looks like a kind of a fierce army guy with a big bald head and kind of husky. But it's a little misleading. But not entirely. He can also be quite tough and husky in demeanor as well.
According to your article, he's known for bluntly speaking truth to power, for running a smart military campaign to take the Iraqi city of Tal Afar, and he's also known for ordering his soldiers to treat detainees humanely and not to use derogatory language toward Muslims. So on that last count, at least, he's a little different from Michael Flynn.
Different from Michael Flynn, but, you know, Michael Flynn was different from just about every general that I've ever met. The modern military general realizes that in the wars that we're fighting now, even those, especially those against Islamic terrorism, our main allies are Muslim governments and Muslim people. And to put them all in the same category is not only stupid, but self-defeating. I mean, you know, you remember when James Mattis, and I'm convinced the only reason why Trump hired Mattis to be Secretary of Defense is that he'd heard his nickname was Mad Dog, and he thought he'd get a real killer. He didn't realize that this is a guy who, when he went to battle, carried around a copy of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations in his rucksack and had a library of 7,000 books, which he frequently consulted when he ran into a problem.
When the level-headed one in your cabinet has the nickname yes. Mad Dog, you know you're
right.
in uncharted territory.
We're all hoping for the deep state to rescue us, right?
I was going to say, so two things. One, I just have a suspicion that it is McMaster's straight-out-of-central casting look that probably helped him get the job. And then two, yeah, speaking of reliance on the deep state, I mean, all I've been hearing in the past, whatever, 12, 24 hours is about how wonderful and thoughtful McMaster's is. And we have heard great things from relatively progressive people about Mattis. And I guess my concern, and I hope it's appropriate to ask, is, you know, there is so much reliance on generals. Like, and these guys seem fine. I mean, should it concern us, though, that Trump is, like, normalizing, like, government by generals? Like, what about the next generation of generals?
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, there is a law on the books that says that the Secretary of Defense cannot be a military officer who has resigned in the previous 7 years. And Mattis had resigned in 3, and the Congress had to pass a special waiver allowing him to, which is only the second time that they've done that. At the time, everybody thought, well, Mattis will be perfect for being a counterweight to Flynn, right? So now you have Mattis and McMaster, and McMaster was under him in Iraq. They know each other well. I'm sure that Mattis had recommended him for this job, just as he'd recommended the guy who decided not to take the job, Harvard. So now you have McMaster is sort of Mattis's person in the White House. And, yeah, we should all be panicked, except when you look at who else is in the White House. And my concern about McMaster is, I mean, he's a very smart guy and bureaucratically savvy, too, but he has almost no Washington experience whatsoever. He's never been involved in, much less leading, a group of interagency officials to decide on policy. You know, we'll see. He will be, and I hope, I've been told, because friends of his urged him. Now, when you go into this interview, be sure to demand that you get to choose your staff, that you have direct lines of authority to the national security bureaucracy, that you have, you know, direct contact with the president. He supposedly asked for these things, and Trump gave him his assurances. The trick to this, the key, you know, the kind of the reverse of the canary in the coal mine is whether K.T. McFarland is out by the end of the month.
That's the deputy national security.
If she's
advisor.
Not out, then I think McMaster has things to worry about.
What's wrong with her?
She's not very smart. And she's basically was hired by Trump because she was a Fox News correspondent or commentator. Her husband is a very rich right-wing banker who had given money to the campaign. Trump saw her on Fox and liked her. She has a very, you know, superficially impressive resume until you look to see what she was doing in these positions, which wasn't much. And everybody on the NSC staff, I mean, you know, she held a meeting with the NSC professionals. These are people, National Security Council.
Career people.
These are career people who have come in from other departments to serve a stint in the National Security Council. Mm-hmm. And she's out, okay, well, let's go out there and make America great again. You know, this is not, it's not supposed to be a partisan thing. So she's a real lightweight, but she has ties with Bannon on all of that's the other thing. Whether
she's
Bannon,
like that.
the other test
concern
is whether, you know, Bannon has this crazy kind of parallel NSC structure called the Strategic Initiatives Group, which is filled with these lunatics, not to put too fine a point on it. And right. That's the other condition. We'll see if that gets disbanded.
Yeah, I mean, my foremost concern with this president is his lack of intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. And so it is good news that McMaster is a learned person who's going to be in this administration and have the president's ear. But I don't think we should just be happy with that. I think that, you know, first of all, he's one of, you know, amidst a bunch of other people who, you know, while they may have technical book learning, are people like Sebastian Gorka, you know, who is a deputy to Stephen Bannon and also Bannon himself. Stephen Miller, yes, you know, who will say anything on any cable news program or as he says. I just think that, you know, McMaster, despite his intelligence, still may be surrounded by a cabal of clowns. And that is why I'm cautiously optimistic that certainly that Michael Flynn is no longer in a position to endanger the United States or foreign policy in the way that he was promised to. But I think that if you have just one guy against Bannon, against Gorka, against Miller, these guys pushing this really disturbing worldview, yeah, and this, you know, Islamophobic, xenophobic policy, which we're due to get more of this week, apparently. I think that, you know, McMaster can only do so much.
And
go ahead.
I was going to say, like, and the only person that ever got rich thinking Trump would keep his word is Trump.
You're right.
And, you know, whatever kind of deal McMaster's might have cut, which just, you know, I'm only going to take this job if XYZ. I mean, ask a Trump contractor. Mm-hmm. How that worked out for them, you know.
Would
I mean,
Darth Vader say, I've altered the deal, pray I don't alter it any further?
Can I just say one more thing about McMaster? Yeah. That he made his mark in the mid-90s. He did a PhD dissertation called Dereliction of Duty. It was published as a book, the thesis of which was that, look, we lost the Vietnam War not because of the media, not because of excessive micromanagement by civilians, but because the Joint Chiefs of Staff were too cowardly to do their constitutional duty and give good military advice to the civilian leadership. Mm. This was against the conventional wisdom in the Army at the time. He had a couple of people on high who liked him and liked his views and supported him, which worked to his advantage, but most of the Army hated him because he was a troublemaker. They wouldn't promote him to general until a special promotion board was assembled, mm-hmm, pretty much for the express purpose of giving McMaster a star. General Petraeus was called back from Iraq to chair this promotion board. People openly called it the H.R. McMaster Promotion Board. So not only does he not cower before authority, he doesn't know how to. I mean, he's kind of instinctively
blunt.
So we'll see what happens. He's never had to deal with the president, you know, and he is still an active duty general. There's mm-hmm, there's a dynamic there where you don't get to rank with the commander in chief. So this will be very interesting drama.
Michael Flynn was, you know, preternaturally blunt too. So I guess the difference that you're arguing is that one was blunt and crazy and the other is blunt and sane.
That's one.
Speaking of blunt and crazy, one detail from your article that I hadn't realized before. You said John Bolton, the provocateur, former Bush UN ambassador with the walrus mustache, was considered for national security advisor, but didn't get it, maybe in part because Trump is said to despise facial hair.
Well,
that's a thing with Trump?
That's what I hear. That's what I hear. But then again, Trump said that we'll find another position for Bolton, because he's very smart, and I agree with a lot of his ideas.
Just so I don't have to see him on cable.
I was going
to
say, somewhere right. perhaps yeah. less visible.
I had an open mind about Trump until now, but now it's over between us.
I think it would be funny if...
For listeners
Trump,
who can't
if
see
Trump
my
said,
face,
I'll give
you can deduce think, through logic.
And now we know, like, if Trump... we'll know who the resistors are in Trump's cabinet. If they start to grow that's facial right. hair, that's how they can send
like
a signal. It's better than blinking Morse code. You know?
I think it would be hilarious if Trump gave Bolton a job, but only on the condition that he shaved that ridiculous mustache.
With Fred Kaplan from Slate and Anna Marie Cox and Jamil Smith from MTV News, Brian Lehrer live from the Green Space today here on WNYC. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Any questions from our audience so far? Anybody want to raise your hand and jump in with a follow-up on anything that's come up so far? Okay, not yet. I'm very shy, quiet. This is what your home state of Minnesota,
radio.
Like you have the, you know, Garrison Keillor yeah. stereotype of the shy people who listen to public radio, but not really. But
they're New Yorkers. Come on, guys.
Really? Jamil, you have an article now on why we need an independent investigation immediately mm-hmm. into the Russia scandal.
Yes.
And so I want to ask you, why call for that specifically? It does seem like the Senate Intelligence Committee is doing a serious inquiry, Democrats and Republicans, or is that not your impression?
No, it's not my impression because, frankly, I mean, you have a Congress that's controlled in both houses by Republicans whose interest in Trump, you know, is to have him sign their agenda into law. Tax cuts, killing Obamacare, limiting abortion rights, voting rights restrictions, gun laws. All these things are, you know, basically going to be filtered, you know, up to the White House for him to sign. So they have an interest in keeping him in office and in depressing this story. So that is why you need a special prosecutor. I mean, Watergate had a special prosecutor. Archibald Cox was appointed on May 18th, 1973, because, frankly, the attorney general designate at the time felt that the investigation could not be handled within Congress or certainly within the White House. And Nixon didn't like that, as you may remember. You know, the famous Saturday Night Massacre in which Cox was fired along with others, but it was already too late at that point. The truth had come to light, and that's what we need to have happen here.
I mean, I don't do a lot of reporting on the Hill because I live in Minnesota, but I've been reaching out to the people that I do know, and everyone is saying that the Republicans are terrified of Trump. Like they've done two things: they've made a deal with the devil in order to get their ideological sort of pet projects passed, mm-hmm. And the single tweet that could get me primaried. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're defanged. I mean, but I would say those people who want to try and get the Congress moving, the showing up at town halls is making a difference. People are also talking about mm-hmm. that. And making it known that they're being watched is also working.
But on this premise, Jamil, that, you know, they're afraid of Trump. They're politically relying on Trump to some degree right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe they would just as soon be done with him if they can find the dirt. And I realize it's so early in his term to be talking about impeachment, but people are talking about impeachment if the Russia scandal winds up in a certain place. And these guys would probably rather have Mike Pence, who's one of them.
Well, there's two factors here, I think, that complicate that. Number one is that special investigations take a long time. Watergate took a long time to come out for everything to drip, drip, drip. It may feel like there's an avalanche of news every day or there's an alert on your phone every single day that makes you wonder what in the world has my country come to. But with this kind of investigation, it's going to take a good long while. So it's not like, you know, there's all the hashtag Trump impeachment party trending. Just slow down, everybody. It's not yet. Not yet.
Is that a hashtag that's trending?
Yeah, it was trending the day that those two stories from the New York Times and CNN came out about, you know, the allegations from intelligence that there was contact between Trump's campaign and Russian intelligence officials. But there's also another factor, which is the fact that, you know, there's just not as much moral courage on the side of the Republican Party as they may seem to think. Mm-hmm. It's not even just about whether or not they're afraid of their own voters or if they're just, you know, trying to get their bills passed, they genuinely, it's become almost like sports. I mean, I covered sports for a very long time. It's just about like, hey, this guy's on my team. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to support him no matter what. I mean, my quarterback may be, you know, throwing five interceptions and, you know, we're, you know, five game losing streak, but he's still my guy.
I think that's why you're seeing, you know, what is sometimes quasi ironically referred to as the deep state, sometimes very paranoid.
Do you want to define that? I know the Breitbart site has been using that, but I gather that it actually comes from Glenn Greenwald,
yeah,
from The Intercept, who's way on the left, like the Edward Snowden ally.
I think Fred probably can give maybe a better definition than I can.
It really comes from, you know, places like Turkey,
yeah,
and Egypt, where there really is a deep, but kind of the under the stream of everything, or Russia sometimes, under the stream of what you see is actually this, the real power, the people who really hold, and it tends to be the military, which in places like Egypt and Turkey also control a good part of the economy,
right,
especially Egypt, and intelligence. There really isn't quite, there's not a coherent,
no,
deep state here. I mean, if you're talking about the source of leaks, and actually I'm not so much in the investigative game these days, so I don't know where these leaks are coming from, but it looks like they're coming from a combination of permanent bureaucracy, you know, civil servants, some Obama holdovers,
mm-hmm,
some intelligence people who are both pissed and worried, genuinely worried. Justice Department, FBI, but these people don't talk. They don't have meetings where they say, "Okay, let's give this to Maggie Haberman, and let's give this to you know." It's not like that.
I think a better description for what might be happening here is sort of permanent bureaucracy, like career service,
mm-hmm,
people, whether it is Justice Department or Intelligence Service or National Security or Foreign Service. What we're seeing is some moral courage from those people,
right,
because they have attached, you know, value to an ideas that are larger than themselves and an idea of America that is larger than themselves. And so they're thinking of that America and those ideals and trying to serve that rather than just the short-term vision of ideology.
As well as their own interests. Keep in mind, Deep Throat was the deputy director of the FBI.
There's always self-interest involved. But I do think that it isn't, like, we aren't seeing like a, you know, quiet coup by the deep state. It's people who are alarmed, and sometimes for personal reasons. And I also do think that there is some sense of like this larger thing that I thought I was serving seems to be threatened.
Yeah, the other thing is, you know, about this moral courage among Congress people. Just, you know, there's an old saying that if you're going to behead the king, you better not miss.
If
word gets around, you mentioned fear of Trump.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy, if somebody in the Republican Party starts speaking out against him, he can throw, you know, a primary challenger at him. Now, people like McCain and even Rubio now, they just got reelected. So they have 6 years before they have to worry about a primary challenge. With people in the House, though, they could have all of their federal funding pulled from the district. I mean, this guy is really vindictive. He has shown this. And so if you want to join a conspiracy to start impeachment proceedings or anything like it, you know, you've got to watch your back if you're one of these. Also, the thing is, look at the polls.
Right.
In the districts where Trump won, he's still very popular. People dig this stuff that he's doing. You know, they're not turning against him. Even the overall polls, you know, is he doing a good job? Is he doing a bad job? The people who think he's doing a good job, it's not that much lower than the percentage of the population that voted for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key also, Fred, is that the Democrats have to get their act together.
Well, that's true, too.
I mean, you know, we have, you know, the upcoming, I guess this Saturday, the Democrats will finally choose the leader of the DNC. Now, that's not a role that's, you know, enormously, I think, important. They've certainly made it more important than it seems to be, you know, in practicality. But Democrats, if there is increased focus from the Democrats on turning out voters who were apathetic, who feel like, you know, the Obama administration maybe abandoned them or didn't serve them in the way that they needed to, you know, communities like, you know, near where I'm from, near Youngstown, Ohio, you know, Lorain, Ohio, those kind of communities that feel like they've been abandoned in this economic recovery. Democrats need to focus on getting people out to put even more pressure on Republicans, because if they don't face any threat electorally or, you know, what, however many other ways you may think of it, if they don't face any threat, there's not going to be any pressure on Republicans to go against Trump.
Brian Lehrer live in the green space on WNYC with Jamil Smith and Anna Marie Cox from MTV News and Fred Kaplan from Slate. Some tweets that are coming in from our listening audience. Glenn Greenwald may have once been a person of the left, but that ended several years ago. He's now a freelance ideologue. Somebody else writes, GOP can control timing and info that comes out of investigation. Trump is still popular, too. Next one, fun fact, today Trump cannot be the shortest serving president ever as he passed Harrison's record for 31 days. And this one says, re-facial hair. If that were true, Bannon wouldn't have that perpetual 5 o'clock shadow.
Oh.
Let's go to Maddie.
Shadowy facial hair. So.
Maddie on Staten Island. Maddie, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
And thank you for taking my question. I'd like the panel to talk about the Constitution and the First Amendment, which our president seems to ignore, is there, and the Second Amendment, which he backs fully. And I'd like to remind everybody that the First Amendment was number one.
There's a lot in the First Amendment. Are you thinking of a particular part?
Well, freedom of speech, right.
Freedom of speech, freedom of the press is the one that's been in the news.
All right, yeah.
Maddie, thank you very much.
Either.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't want to get bogged down in this today. We did a lot on it yesterday, and I think that the media...
We have the freedom to not get bogged down in it, actually.
We do.
Yeah.
Here we are. Nobody.
Freedom,
freedom the stormtroopers aren't coming.
Freedom to not speak.
Yeah.
But seriously, I think that there's a tendency on the part of the press to take the bait every time from Trump when he disses the press, and he escalates it because he knows he's going to get people on cable TV and everywhere to run down the rabbit hole. Oh, now he said enemy of the people, or whatever it is. And then we're not focusing on the policies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you think that that's a deliberate distraction? There's a big debate about
I actually think it's useless to – I don't want to even argue about whether or not it's a deliberate distraction, because, like, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if it's a deliberate thing or he just happens to be the luckiest, you know, son of a gun on earth. He is sowing confusion. He is sowing distrust. And we in the media, I think, you know, we should call out when he uses phrases like enemy of the people, which is a phrase associated with despots and dictators.
Clearly.
That specific phrase. And there is someone in the White House who is a self-proclaimed Leninist. Lenin wrote a essay called Enemies of the People. So someone in the White House knows what that phrase means.
Oh, yeah.
So we should point that out. And then we should continue to do our job.
I mean,
it's a big mistake to do much, because we're not that popular either.
Yeah.
And if we start getting defensive and then it becomes all about us,
report the connections, for instance, on the phrase, and then move on.
And, I mean, the key to me is to concentrate on how this White House uses facts or uses untruths. I mean, not to focus on whether or not they like us. I don't care if anybody in the White House likes me or anybody else in the press. I care about how they twist facts so that they can get away with lies to the American people. And so that makes it easier for them to then manipulate the American people. That's what we should be focusing on and making sure that our reporting and our commentary reflects that.
Satima in where? Jersey City. Satima, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning. Wonderful panel. Really great choice, Brian.
Thank you.
I'm from North Africa, and when you asked if your audience could have some question, I guess they're so overwhelmed. But we are from North Africa. We've been hearing about things like that. It's like common usual things happening around us. And I think my comment vis-a-vis the choices of more and more generals in the cabinet is a very alarming. I agree with your female, the lady who is in your panel.
Anna Marie
Cox.
It's
very alarming. It's very alarming.
National political correspondent for MTV
News.
It's
just like a normalization of having uniform being, you know, around us and being the representing the authority around us. So that's number one. Number two, the other person in the panel said that the new nominee requested a direct link with the president, and that is very important because what happened is that the generals who are in charge of the missions, wherever they are posted, need that direct link, and their message gets diluted by the surroundings of the president or whoever is at the head of the country, and that could cause major, major problems. And we have tons of examples of that back in our countries, back in Africa.
Sadama, thank you very much. Fred, that was for you.
Yeah, one clarification. You know, he's not a nominee. He's a member of the White House staff. He is appointed. There's no
Senate confirmation. Why is it that the National Security Advisor, such an important role, doesn't need Senate confirmation?
Well, you know, the role has evolved over time. The complete title is Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. It's a National Security Advisor. So he's one of the White House staff. When it was first formed, it was basically like General Goodpaster, who was Eisenhower's National Security Advisor, was basically the note taker at National Security Council meetings, and he organized the meetings. He brought together all the different views, presented them to the president. He was sort of an honest broker. Mm-hmm. This changed when McGeorge Bundy was Kennedy's national security advisor. He became a much more active player in the deliberations. And since then, it's kind of gone back and forth. And there are different styles of national security advisor. For example, Condoleezza Rice, when she was Bush's, she found that herself completely outflanked by Rumsfeld and Cheney, couldn't control the bureaucracy at all. So she made it her job to deal with the president and had an enormous influence on the president's views, and vice versa, by the way. He had an enormous influence. So the whole role of it often depends on what the president wants to do with the
there was really a national security advisor named Goodpaster?
Yeah, Andrew Goodpaster. Yeah.
It's like the Outer Bridge Crossing. People think it's because it's on the fringe of New York City, but it was really named after a guy named Outer Bridge.
Outer Bridge. Well, there was a chief of Air Force Intelligence once named General Keel Marks.
Oh, boy. Let me get your takes on what matters and what doesn't matter about the Russia scandal. Because I think it's easy to get lost in the weeds. We know from the intelligence agencies with a pretty high degree of certainty that Russia hacked the DNC during the election to help Trump get elected. If we accept that much as a starting point,
yes.
We now have the reporting from The Times, which has been so highly disputed by Trump and his people in the last few days, that people from his campaign had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence officials during the campaign. Now, that would mean not just Russian diplomats, which might be ordinary, but Russian spies, if that's what intelligence officials means. Excuse me. And I think Reuters today has its own sources who confirm the story. But here it gets more uncertain. And I wonder if you've all read the Times story and how much credence you give it with its anonymous sources and other degrees of evidence. Fred.
But, you know, this story came out in October. I remember reading it. But what's new about the recent stories is that they seem to be based on intercepts of telephone calls. Yeah. You know, if you call up the Russian embassy, that call is being recorded by the NSA. Now, it's not being monitored in real time, but it's there. It's files. They can go back and look at it. They've obviously gone back and looked at some of this stuff. Yeah. And now this information has been shared not only with FBI investigations that are going on, but according to the Reuters the other day, investigations by the counterintelligence branches of the FBI, who have sources in foreign intelligence organizations and are tracing bank transactions through front organizations. Now, again, none of this might pan out, But if it does, then we're talking about something really the kind of thing that even a cowardly Republican congressman might say, yes. Well, this has gone a little bit too far.
It might be the Milo moment for them.
Yeah.
I think that this, no matter, it doesn't really matter almost like what we might assess here. There was a lot of anonymous sources. It's not clear whether or not this was ineptitude and bad judgment or actual malice, which is why we need an independent investigation.
Exactly.
Because we can't answer these questions.
Right.
We don't have enough information.
We need
someone
more facts.
Needs to be able to answer those questions.
Because in terms of it being a scandal for Trump himself, and with that hashtag, what was that hashtag?
Trump impeachment party.
I don't like that
Ain't
hashtag.
Ain't no party like a Trump impeachment party.
Exactly.
Way too many characters for a hashtag.
It'd be lit.
Yeah, it's
but
long.
If this goes a certain way, it could be Trump's Watergate, which was, after all, a break-in at Democratic headquarters. But I would say, as a starting point, unless Trump personally colluded to hack the DNC or personally knew about it and winked at it, he himself is not vulnerable, and this whole thing kind of peters out. Or do you disagree with that?
Well, we don't know where these threads lead. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, like Fred said, like these are counterintelligence agencies that are now involved. Like there are, you know, people monitoring things like bank transactions. We don't have Trump's taxes. At base level, this is gross negligence. To call a Russian to apparently make these calls not knowing they were being recorded, well, that's just stupid.
Yeah, from the guy who was director of the DIA.
Yeah, that's
point,
just
you know.
That's just plain dumb fireable fence right there. there might be more to it. We don't know, which is why we need an investigation. I mean, I think people need to kind of like, I'm in favor of erring on the side of panic in general, especially when it comes to Trump. But, you know, let's, okay, we've had our moment of like, oh, you know, geez. Take some deep breaths and lobby your congressman for an investigation. Like,
well,
that's what we need to do.
I think that there are two ways of looking at it. One, I think what Trump is concerned about, and this is would be true whether or not he was directly complicit, was that this threatens to delegitimize his presidency.
Yep.
If it looks like he got elected, even in part because of Russian interference, that plus his losing the popular... You know, why does he say things like, I have the biggest electoral votes in history, or I would have won
Wrong.
The popular vote too if it hadn't been for fraudulent votes? It's
Wrong.
Because these
yeah.
three things added together... These three things added together make him look like an illegitimate. You know, it's
Warmer.
George W. Bush.
Yeah.
You know, he lost the popular vote. George W. Bush lost the popular vote by 500,000.
Yeah.
And it's no. We saw in retrospect that disturbed him. He didn't quite feel he'd earned the presidency because when he was reelected, he said, "Now with the people's vote behind my back, giving me wind," which suggested that he didn't feel that wind.
Well, you shouldn't. When he was I mean,
in
like,
right.
I mean, if you don't win the popular vote, that should govern your behavior a little bit.
And also,
you know?
Yeah,
maybe
the fact that 75%.
Yeah. To your
if you account for everybody who didn't vote for him, everybody, like people who voted for Clinton, voted for Jill Stein, whomever, and then didn't vote, what have you? More than 75% of this country did not vote for him. That has to eat at his ego.
Except that he takes the low turnout from people of color as somehow an affirmation.
Oh, well, that's a badge of honor.
the fact that they didn't like they liked him okay. I mean, I don't know what the logic
oh, no,
is.
Well, I mean,
like,
the way he probably thinks that every black person in America voted
for him. Against him.
You know,
they didn't like him enough. They didn't dislike him more enough than they disliked Hillary.
They stayed home.
Yeah.
They stayed home, so they must not hate
him. They must not hate him, yeah.
Now that we've not sorted that out, we're going to take a break and continue with Anna Marie Cox and Jamil Smith from MTV News and Fred Kaplan from Slate. 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer live in the green space today. Brian Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC, live from the Green Space today with Jamil Smith and Anna Marie Cox, national political reporters for MTV News. Anna Marie also has a new podcast called With Friends Like These. And we have Slate's War Stories columnist, Fred Kaplan, whose work is very relevant to what's going on right now. His current book is Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. And he has interviewed extensively the new national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, who figures prominently in Fred's previous book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Our phones are open, 212-433-WNYC. We'll take some questions from our Green Space audience, too, as we go along here. But I want to take a big step back with you three and get all of you to weigh in on the big picture of Trump's first month, even beyond what we've been talking about. Because I think Trump supporters and Trump detractors not only see things differently, they aren't even seeing the same things. So Trump supporters say month one, and he's been trying to make a big point of this, and all the surrogates have. I think this was maybe even the main reason for the news conference the other day, which, you know, people in the media tended to deride as wacky, which it was, but he was trying to do something, and that is to give a message that he has started keeping his campaign promises, and all we talk about is Russia. So he says Dakota and Keystone pipelines back on, U.S. funding for women's health clinics overseas that discuss abortion back off, the first wave of cracking down on criminals who are unauthorized immigrants check. The first attempt to limit travel from the most terrorism-prone Muslim nations, check. The first wave of easing rules on the coal industry, check. The first wave of bullying car makers to keep some more jobs in the U.S., check. Nominating a Scalia originalist to the Supreme Court, check. And I could go on. Mm-hmm. Jamil, where do you want to start with that?
Well, I mean, let's start with the fact that, he didn't stop immigration from the seven most terrorism-prone countries. What he did was he sought to limit immigration from seven Muslim countries that where he does not do business. So
they are not actually the most terror-prone countries in
exactly.
terms of who's committing terrorist attacks
exactly.
in
zero,
this country.
My take is this month has been all for show. It's all a big show. And whether that involves a sort of reality show theatrics of that press conference or, some of the things that, have gone on, it's Sean Spicer's press briefings. I think that, it's all been, like you said, a message to his base, and that is who he's governing for. It should be a message to the rest of the American people that didn't vote for him and don't support him that he's not governing for them. And also, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about facts. The twisting of facts is so deliberate and so voluminous as far as, what we see in our news that, it's creating a space where, there are people who are, believing one thing and other people believing something else. And it creates an opportunity for him to then pretty much do what he wants. Mm-hmm. And that's how authoritarians roll.
Not to plug my own podcast, but to plug my own podcast. The idea of it is actually around this unfortunate situation we're in where we don't agree about facts. This is something that is true in my life. I have members of my family who are Trump supporters. And it is something that's, I think, true in everyone's life. We're all living with this divide. And I don't know what to do. I don't have a solution. I don't have a prescription, which is one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, because I want to talk to people about why they believe what they believe. Like, that's where I get stuck. Mm-hmm. It's just easy answer is to say we have media bubbles and ideological silos. But what makes people believe a thing that is not true, and why do they mistrust what I say? And is there a way to get out of that? Because social science and psychology, even neuroscience, shows us that when people are presented with information that disagrees with their worldview, that sometimes can re-entrench them into their worldview.
Yep.
How do you move on from that? And I don't know what the media can do. What I'm going to try to do in my personal life and in this podcast and with MTV is try to just figure out what it is we can say to each other. And this is sort of key to me, is I'm going to make it a goal of my own. I'm going to give up on trying to convince people, because that doesn't seem to work, and try and figure out like why it is we disagree.
Or the media writ large needs to just report the facts. And so if they don't lose their minds every time he says what happened in Sweden last night, which was a specific instead of a generalization that he was actually referring to, or when he says 3 million votes, that even though that's really a made-up lie, and focus on what's in the immigration order and what's in the deportation sweeps.
And honestly, also focus on the people who are affected by this, because telling stories about those people can change minds.
Right. But here's one reason why I will continue to lose my mind whenever he lies about votes, you know, illegal votes or, you know, terrorist attacks in Sweden. Really.
Jamil rolled his eyes kind of.
Descriptive to the listeners. I feel like those lies enable policies that then oppress people. He lies about votes. We now have 21 states working on voter restriction laws enabled by that lie. Terrorist attacks in Sweden, oh my gosh, committed by refugees, which he clearly inferred. That potentially could provoke violence here in the states against refugee communities, or even against if they're citizens. They just might be brown.
Talking about a 45-year crime wave empowers people to... You know,
that lie.
It's utterly reckless and it's dangerous. And that's why I lose my mind over it.
Who's got their hand up here? Let's take a question from the audience. This gentleman right. Oh, yeah. OK. Nope. Wherever you are. Where's the microphone? Go ahead. Hi.
There you go.
Hi. So I'm interested in the effectiveness of citizen opposition to Trump. I've gone, I guess, in the last month to 5 or 6 demonstrations, maybe more. And now I'm reading in the Times that it may be counterproductive. And then last night, I happened to see a movie on the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. And the thesis was the people taking to the streets over 3 or 4 days, the crowd kept increasing. And that led to the demise of the repressive Czechoslovakian government. So am I wasting my time when I go out in the streets? And what is effective? Thank you.
Thank you. That's such an important question right now.
I don't think you're wasting your time, but don't expect the revolution to happen the next day. I mean, this is a long-term thing. And people are counting on you to become exhausted. And it is true that the first few demonstrations, big deal. The 4th, the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, it's another demonstration. What needs to be done is follow-up. I mean, Jamil, you were talking about, you know, all these things going on in the states. I mean, the states are where a lot of things are happening. Obama's farewell address, he goes, you know, if you don't like your leaders, you know, grab a clipboard and get some petitions and run for office yourself, or at least vote. You know, I don't know if it's true, but Charles Schumer said that when he was at the Women's March, he went around talking with some people, and by his informal survey, 20% of the people who were there hadn't voted.
That would be a lot.
Of the people who did vote, 10% had voted for someone other than Hillary Clinton. I mean, you know, snap out of it. An election is not an exercise in psychoanalysis. It's not to make you feel good about your choice. Yeah. No, it's an election. Here are two people who have a chance of winning. Pick the one that you like better, even if it's just by a little bit.
Thank you.
The lesser of two evils is the lesser of two evils.
I want to talk to some of these people who were, Hillary is a plutocrat. I want to talk to them right now about her affiliation with
Goldman Sachs.
Right.
And the corruption of the Clinton Foundation.
Emails, Fred. Emails.
I want to go to the next questioner from the audience. Is it right there? Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. I love your show. I listen to it all the time. So my question, I guess, is about media in general, kind of similar like, as media consumers, people who read, I'm sure, and listen to NPR, there's a lot of information out there, and you're hearing a lot, and people are freaking out. How do you sort of keep the calm and make sure that you're filtering it through and finding the facts, and what would be your recommendations?
Can I grab this one? First of all, of course, there are always pet pictures. They're a vital part of anyone's Twitter feed, especially mine. And that's the keeping calm part. And I'm not entirely kidding. Like, you know, self-care is a word that gets thrown around by us snowflakes a lot. But you got to stay cool. Stay a snowflake. And it also, you know, taking care of yourself is what enables you to do the long haul of protesting. That protest in a year is going to be as important, if not more important, than the protests that are happening now. I just want to endorse protesting right off the bat. And if we look at the civil rights movements that have come before us, they're always a combination of being in the streets and being in the ballot box and being in town halls. But to get to the media diet question, look at things that you love, whatever that may be. Cubs. I also do pet pictures.
That's a Chicago thing.
Yeah, the Chicago thing. Chris Bryant in particular.
In case they think
I don't know if anyone's ever looked at Chris Bryant, but he's
pet
a calming,
keeping habit.
Very calming presence. Okay, so I mean, and I'm not, again, I am not entirely kidding. You know, engage in things that you love. And then also, I think, you know, try and pick a few authoritative sources that are probably going to be people that you already trust, maybe, like the New York Times, NPR, whoever that is. And then I do endorse trying to find some voices on your ideological opposite that you also can trust. And those might be harder for you to find because you're instinctively are suspicious. But they're out there. And also, if you read them through the lens of, like, I'm going to be suspicious, but I'm also going to check the links here. You know, I'm going to, like, I think National Review has some good people. Yeah, I know. I'm trying to think. But Matt Lewis, who's conservative, had a great column in the Daily Beast today about Jamil is, like, subtweeting me visually right now. But, you know, Matt K. Lewis at Daily Beast had a great column today about why the right embraced Milo. So he in particular is a columnist that I think basically because they needed, you know, they fell in love with the sort of fabulousness and ignored the message. I don't know if that's helpful, but like I do think it's important to try and find some sources that you're not going to that are going to be tougher to read because it keeps you sharp.
Yeah. I want to stay on the 1 month big picture.
Oh,
a little
sorry.
Bit. No. I'm not correcting you. I'm just there are some other things that I want to get in and try to sort of complete the thought. I'm just going to, you know, he's not the only one who said it, but Chuck Todd's conclusion about the first month on Meet the Press, I think, is worth repeating. He said, if we thought during the campaign that Trump was a deal maker and a self-aggrandizer with no ideology, we now know that he does have an ideology after all. He's a nationalist. How much do you agree with that?
We knew that before the election.
Yeah, he's a white nationalist.
Right.
I mean
it was. Yeah, it was clear he was pushing policies that embolden white supremacy. Let's just strip away the fancy language and just call it what it is. He proposes policies and puts forth ideas that make life easier for white people. Period.
And strengthen and entrench policies that support their comfort and privilege, whatever. I actually meant to jump when I was jumping in about his lie about the 45-year high crime rate, just a lie. That is a lie. One of the things that does is sort of gives weight to the idea that we're living in this, you know, hellhole where police need to be more empowered to do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm.
And that means against people of color.
Yeah.
Right. And funny enough, this is where the Milo story comes in for me, because Milo is sort of a clown provocateur, an alt-right Abby Hoffman, to use a 1960s reference that some have used. But what Milo represents on his college tours and on Breitbart is normalizing the disparagement of blacks, Muslims, LGBT folks, even though he's gay, and women, very much women.
Jews.
And I guess Jews, I didn't even know about that part until today. Normalizing all those white male Christian nationalist kinds of prejudice under the name of free speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and free speech, more power to – there are street corners available across the country for him to shout at. You know, I mean, like, he has every right to say whatever he wants to say. To privilege him is what is disturbing to a lot of us. To give him attention, to pretend like what he has to say is normal or interesting, just because it makes people mad. I mean,
so he got uninvited from speaking to the CPAC, the big conservative conference, because.
Oh, can we get to talk about this?
Well, I mean, okay, so he said things that seemed to...
wording of the organizer of CPAC, Matt Schlapp, was that he was normalizing pedophilia, which is not inaccurate. I mean, basically he was saying, like, one of the quotes, I won't say the full quote, but I'm thankful to Father Michael. I would not be as adept at certain things without him. Like, that's what he...
Certain
sexual activities without him.
And that contact was when he was a minor?
Minor, yeah. And he was saying that he was sort of lauding this. And that apparently, so finally found out what's too much. You know, it wasn't disparagement.
It's good to know where the lines are drawn, you know?
If only we had tape of another person bragging about sexual assault who's going to speak at CPAC.
That was with women. See?
I know,
heterosexual.
Boy talk.
I mean, the key to why Milo, to me, is so dangerous is that he uses sexism. You know, he appeals to this young male demographic that feels rejected, that feels alone, that feels set apart. And he uses that as a way to, like, sort of, it's like a, you know, starter drug for white supremacy.
Yeah. He valorizes their isolation as having been like a triumph of some kind.
Right.
And that is like literally empowering. It's actually this weirdly identity politics. It's like the inverse of everything that the left tries to do, in the sense that it's empowering these people and telling them that their so-called oppression gives them license to do and say whatever they want.
So this is the point to which we've come. On Morning Joe on MSNBC today, they asked the head of the American Conservative Union why he invited Milo in the first place to speak at CPAC. And this exchange to me was extraordinary. It starts with Joe Scarborough's question.
He's also made some extraordinarily offensive anti-Semitic remarks. So can't you find somebody else? Like, get Ted Cruz to fire off a speech against PC codes on college campuses. Get anybody at CPAC that's not an anti-Semite.
Yeah, Joe, it's a fair point. But the other point is that whether we like it or not, he is a big voice in this movement. And we believe that our attendees can handle it and make their own judgments on whether or not they think a speaker is saying what is accurate or being inaccurate or being hateful. I don't want to shield that kind of conversation from our attendees. Matter of fact, a lot of our attendees want to have these controversies before them and make their own choices.
So I really did a double take when I heard that, and I went back and listened to it two more times, because have we really reached a point already on day 31 where the mainstream conservative movement at its most high-profile annual conference is putting anti-Semitism into play as a legitimate topic for pro and con
and
debate.
And let people make their own decisions.
Exactly.
Right. Let's have it. I mean, like, I can't even.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at the facts. 11 JCCs were threatened yesterday.
Yeah.
11 of them.
Yesterday.
In a coordinated, what looks to be a coordinated pattern, and we have heard nothing from the President of the United States. That speaks volumes.
You know,
is it true that Ivanka put up a website and then it was taken down?
There
she tweeted against this, and
in
it was
her first.
Oh, she did put up a second one.
Yeah, I think she did too. Right. Yeah.
You know the old hypothetical people use about the media, saying the media is too, on the one hand this and on the one hand that. It's like, if you were in Nazi Germany, would you have debated the Holocaust pro or con, like a legitimate
debate? Let's put it in
debate?
Front of our attendees and see what they think. You know, I mean, and also, like, there's the whole problem of it being as though it were pro and con, and then there's also that one side, the side that Milo represents is full of lies.
Right.
I mean, it's not like we're even.
Did you have a problem with Bill Maher putting him on the other night?
Yes.
Yeah.
Unequivocally. I mean, here's the thing. It's the same problem I had with putting someone, you know, this other, you know, conservative host whose name I'm not going to publicize onto The Daily Show. You give these people an audience and they can then build the audience. And with Milo, and that thought I expressed earlier was, you know, something my friend Amanda Marcotte had put on Twitter, is that, you know, again, you were putting white supremacy on the airwaves. That is what it is. Recognize it and call it what it is. Don't soft pedal it. And it certainly, it suddenly becomes a lot less, you know, tasteful for your audience.
We're going to leave it there for now. Please thank Jamil Smith and Anna Marie Cox from MTV News and Fred Kaplan from Slate. Anna Marie also has her new podcast with friends like these, and Fred has his book, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. We're all like, I think we all have chills after that last stretch of conversation, but we will leave it suspended at that point and pick it up as we go.